Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's episode of the Mem Podcast. I'm Demi Wright, and if you haven't already, don't forget to join us on Instagram at mem.cast for a weekly question of the week. This week, we have joining us again, Dr. Elizabeth Hart, who's an infectious disease consultant in the East Midlands. Hi, Dr. Hart.
Hi, Demi. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Thanks for joining us again. So Dr. Hart did a fabulous talk on the travel history ins and outs. So if you haven't checked that out yet, don't forget to do that after this podcast. So today we have another really interesting topic. So we're going to be talking about viral hemorrhagic fevers. So let's just start. So Dr. Hart, what do you mean when you say viral hemorrhagic fevers?
So what I mean when I'm talking about a viral hemorrhagic fever are those viral infections that can cause outbreaks and that have or can have very serious consequences for the people who have them, often because there is no treatment or vaccination available. And we've had the concerns regarding Ebola in Western Africa a few years ago. Yeah. So what I was hoping to do was to talk through the assessment of someone who might have viral hemorrhagic fever and the steps you would take.
Okay, fair enough. So before we get into to that segment of it, could you just say how common this is or how frequently you come across it in your practice?
I am very glad to say I have never actually treated someone with a viral hemorrhagic fever.
Okay.
Because it is one of those, I think every speciality has its like red flags and alarming things, but yeah. A viral hemorrhagic fever is something that sets off alarms with us.
Okay.
We have a number of people on a yearly basis who come through that we need to do a viral hemorrhagic fever assessment on.
Okay.
But from previous studies that have been done in the UK, we know that there are many people who might meet the criteria to be assessed for a viral hemorrhagic fever who no one ever thinks of it on, and they go through the system and then they're either picked up on audit or they're picked up a few days later thinking, oh no, should we have thought about Lassa or Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever or something? But by then something else has become obvious.
Right.
I think what we don't want is somebody with a horribly easy to transmit virus sitting on the middle of a general medical ward or in the emergency department, potentially infecting many others before anyone has realised this might be an issue.
Right. Okay. So do you want to just walk us through the assessment that you mentioned?
Yeah, happily. So the first thing is to think about it, which means that you need to know that someone has been abroad. So this comes back to that travel history. And if someone comes in with a febrile illness, hopefully they would volunteer that they had been abroad. But if they didn't, it should be part of a routine screening. If someone comes back with infection, have you been abroad?
Okay.
What I'm using at the moment is the viral hemorrhagic fever risk assessment from the UK Department of Health site. Again, I suspect that all countries will have access to their own versions of this, but I do think that this is very translatable to many other countries.
Yes.
So what I was going to do was talk through this.
Okay.
What this contains is an algorithm to decide, do I need to worry or not, as well as links to countries where you can find viral hemorrhagic fevers,
yeah,
and as well as a map of Africa, which will show recent outbreaks. Again, if someone has come back from a country and you're not sure about it, there is the NAFNAC website. People will have their own favourites that you can briefly look at to see whether you need to worry. So first question, once you know that they've travelled somewhere, has the patient travelled to any area where there is a current viral hemorrhagic fever outbreak?
Mm-hmm.
Or has the patient lived or worked in basic rural conditions in an area where Lassa fever is endemic? certainly here we see a lot of patients who have come from Nigeria, and there are areas in Nigeria where Lassa fever is endemic. And you also want to know, referring back to what have you done on your holiday, has the patient visited any caves or mines, had contact with or eaten primates, antelopes or bats in a Marburg or Ebola endemic area? And the last Ebola outbreak was linked with people eating bushmeat, so animals that have been caught in the wild that probably had Ebola, which is how it got into the human population.
Okay.
And an additional question is, has the patient travelled in an area where Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever is endemic and sustained a tick bite or crushed a tick with their bare hands or had close involvement with animal slaughter? Not necessarily questions you're going to ask as a routine part of your own.
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought to ask any of those things.
I guess the main message is that if you've got any concern, the information is easy to find on the internet. And, you know, don't worry about it, just pull it up. Or alternatively, if you do have these concerns and you have access to an infectious diseases team, this is something that we want to be talking to people about. If someone is worried, we want to be able to go through these questions and reassure everyone that there is no risk to themselves. That's really important, but to also make sure that the patient gets the care that they require.
Right.
So if you answer yes to any of those questions, you then go to the patient and go, does the patient have a fever? They've quoted greater than 37.5 or a history of fever in the past 24 hours. And if they say no to that question, that's fine. Don't worry about it. But if they say yes to that question, the next one you find out about is how long is it since they left the viral hemorrhagic fever area? So the incubation period for viral hemorrhagic fevers is up to 3 weeks. So if they've been back for 4 weeks, again, I'm not worried. That's fine. But if it's less than 3 weeks, then we need to continue with the assessment.
Okay.
So thinking about the questions that I've mentioned previously about areas where there's current outbreaks, where they've worked, sort of contact with antelopes or bats or animal slaughter. If the answer to any of those questions is yes, it is a high possibility of a viral hemorrhagic fever. And that means they should be put into a side room immediately.
Okay.
Now, you and I, Demi, know that there are not many side rooms available in the hospital at the moment, but this is the point where you start involving people in the chain of command. Yeah. So you involve the nurse in charge, you involve whichever consultant is at way, because this is someone that you need to isolate.
Okay.
Hopefully they will turn out not to have something, but you need to protect the staff and other patients and things. So this is one where you stamp your foot and say, this person needs to be in a side room and they need to be in a side room now.
Okay. And in terms of protecting the staff, like what sort of PPE should the staff be using?
Okay. So if you are concerned that someone is a high possibility of viral hemorrhagic fever, at that stage, you obviously do your hand hygiene. We do that all the time. Your double glove, so that you can take off one set of gloves and then sterilise the underlying one and take it off. There's a fluid repellent, coverall or gown, plastic apron, head cover, whatever you have available. In theory, surgical boots and an FFP3 mask. Now, this is, or is probably going to echo what people remember from COVID when it was first around. So I think people are a lot more familiar with this these days and putting it on properly and taking it off properly than they were pre-COVID. So I think, I don't know, am I allowed to say that that is a positive of COVID, that people are more familiar with and better with PPE?
Yeah, I would say that's, I think you're allowed to say that.
I'm allowed to say that, thank you. All right. I mean, certainly in our hospital, by the time somebody has thought, oh my goodness, could this be a viral hemorrhagic fever, they have probably already had blood tests done.
Yeah.
But the blood tests that do need doing are an urgent malaria screen, full blood count, use and ease, so renal function, liver tests, a clotting screen, a CRP, glucose and blood cultures. And to keep your lab sweet, it is massively important that if you have concerns about a viral hemorrhagic fever, you write it on very big letters on whatever form there is or whatever electronic form, and ideally follow it up with a call, because these samples are kept in the lab until you can either de-escalate them. They have to be processed in a slightly different way than normal tests. And the first one that will be done will be a malaria film in a laminar flow cabinet, so in a very protected way, because if that is positive, it does help you de-escalate your patient.
Okay.
It's probably at this point in time that I would be wanting someone to call me and say, I think I've got someone who might have a viral hemorrhagic fever. What shall I do?
Yeah.
And in these days where everyone has phone calls, my first thing would be to try and get the phone number of the patient, ideally in a side room, and then to phone them and talk through the risks to see whether I could de-escalate at that point in time or whether I needed to sort of continue with the process.
Okay.
It's often easier for me to do it because I know how to find everything than expecting someone who's never done it before, who's also got lots of other things to do. Yeah. But talking to the patient and finding out what has gone on is really important.
Right. Okay. So one of the things that you mentioned that's probably likely is, you know, that they would have had a lot of contact with various staff prior to, you know, someone raising that flag of, oh, actually, could this be it? So is there any sort of like post-exposure prophylaxis or anything that these staff should have?
I think in the immediate case, if you are worried that somebody might have a viral hemorrhagic fever, what we ask you to do is keep a list of staff who have been involved.
Okay.
And the honest truth is that a viral hemorrhagic fever is highly unlikely, and it is much more likely to be due to something else. So as a standard, we would say we would like a list of everyone who has had contact with the patient. So maybe face to face without any masks on, although I have noticed we are wearing masks again at the moment.
Yeah.
So someone who's maybe done the blood tests, someone who has taken the history, done an examination. We'd want a list of all their names. In the unlikely event that they are proven to have a viral hemorrhagic fever, we often ask people to do their temperature twice a day for 3 weeks. And if they get a temperature, they'll be brought into a side room and have the appropriate investigations.
Okay.
Certainly after Ebola, the Ebola outbreak, there are potentially more things that have been tried and might work. So we've used ribavirin for some viral hemorrhagic fevers. There are Ebola vaccines at the moment, but I suspect the honest truth is that it might even be something unexpected. So for most of these things, we don't have anything other than supportive management.
Right. Okay.
So if I'm going to continue talking through my little algorithm, we've got a patient in a side room with a possible viral hemorrhagic fever. If the malaria test is positive, I go, oh, that's slightly reassuring. Let's manage as malaria, but we might still need to consider viral hemorrhagic fever.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that might make you worry is if the patient has extensive bruising or active bleeding or uncontrolled diarrhea or vomiting. Now, most of the people I've had to do a risk assessment on have actually been relatively well. And it's a relatively straightforward process. If somebody is unwell, you would consider giving them some empiric treatment whilst you got all the right samples off.
Mm-hmm.
And your empiric treatment is going to be malaria treatment, because malaria is so much more common than a viral hemorrhagic fever. Yeah. But I would probably also give someone a broad spectrum antibiotic like ceftriaxone in case it was a typhoid or something like that.
Okay.
So if they're unwell, best guess treatment, get all your samples off, and the samples will be going off to a laboratory in the country for an extensive panel of investigations. They have to be transported in a particular way, they have to be transported by a particular company, and the lab have to be very aware of this because they need to be prepared or bagged up in a special way.
Okay.
I can say from personal experience, the worst time to do a viral hemorrhagic fever is on a bank holiday weekend where nothing is happening for 4 days.
Oh,
and
gosh.
Yes, the transport company aren't answering their phone. That was a particularly testing time for someone who was absolutely fine. But your laboratory will have its own protocols. So in many respects, the message is spread the misery around, because people do have protocols for this.
Yeah.
But they will only activate them when they are aware of them.
Okay.
And so they are there. But it's much better to say they might have, rather than, oh, by the way, they had. And then there's a lot of meltdown in various areas of the hospital.
Right. So in terms of those protocols would advise what specific samples to send and then therefore how to transport them.
You want the serology samples for them. So some of the ones from those initial screens, they can use them for the serology samples as well.
Okay.
Realistically, if you're going to take blood out of someone, take a couple of extra bottles for serology, because it's so much easier than having to go in and do it all over again.
Yeah. Okay.
There's lots of things about what to do if you think it's unlikely, but I think by that stage we will hopefully have sucked people up to our ward, and if they have a confirmed viral hemorrhagic fever, then we would be trying to transfer them in one of the not very many high level isolation unit ambulances down to the Royal Free Hospital in London's the Hospital for Tropical Diseases.
Right. Okay. So I imagine these diseases will definitely be notifiable.
They are without doubt notifiable. I think we're very lucky at the moment because our notification process has now gone electronic, which is much easier than phoning someone up or trying to find the right form. Some notifiable diseases, you would just send the form. If you were worried about a viral hemorrhagic fever, I would absolutely say that you must notify your local health protection teams locally, because they will need to know about this.
Yeah.
And it's much nicer to de-escalate something because you thought about it and did the right things than have to go back and do these things retrospectively.
Yeah, good point. Was there anything else you wanted to mention about it?
I think it's really to emphasise that we do miss a lot of people who should probably have a viral hemorrhagic fever assessment. And it's because we don't necessarily think about it. And in this world of international travel and pandemics and things, I think it will become increasingly important. And I think as a medical registrar, you are the person in charge. You have a lot of responsibility. And it also makes you look really good if you're the person who says, hang on a moment, have we thought about a viral hemorrhagic fever? Even if you can de-escalate in 5 minutes. You know, the fact that you're thinking about it is a definite tick in your box of registrar skills.
Yeah, I think from now on, any fever, I'll be thinking, have we thought of viral hemorrhagic fever?
Oh, I'll expect a phone call from you, Demi, at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Well, yeah, thank you so much, Dr. Hart. That was really, really interesting and really useful.
It was my absolute pleasure, Demi. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us. And to our listeners, don't forget to join us at mem.cast on Instagram for a weekly question of the week. And if you do have any special requests, please do get in touch. See you next time.